This audio is from the 2011 Dublin Anarchist Book Fair. This is the session entitled The Arab Spring, News and Reflections, where an anarchist recently returned from Egypt gives us news of the state of the struggle for greater freedom in the post-Mubarak era. You'll find more audio from the Dublin Anarchist Book Fair at www.wsm.ie.
Hello everybody, welcome to the Anarchist Book Fair. My name is Oran, I'm going to be facilitating this meeting on the Arab Spring News and Reflection by this man here, José Antonio Gutiérrez Danton. He's just returned from Egypt with news of the state of the struggle for greater freedom in the post-Mubarak era. It's also going to be an opportunity to discuss the wider winds of change sweeping through North Africa and the Middle East, sparked by the Tunisian uprising. José Antonio, he's a Chilean anarchist living in Dublin, a prolific writer on anarchismo.net and in myriad publications. He writes, translates, and links anarchist and anti-imperialist struggles from across Latin America, through Europe, to the Middle East, and further abroad. I'm going to ask everyone if they could turn off or make silent their mobile phones, and I'll hand you over to José Antonio for his talk. Oh, yes, sir.
Thanks. Thanks, that was a very, very generous description, so thanks for that. Yeah, I'm just coming back from Egypt now, and that's why the idea of organizing this talk came into being. It was a very interesting experience from a number of perspectives, particularly because you realize how much of a gap exists between the struggles going on here and the struggles going on there, a number of misconceptions, a number of common misunderstandings. So it was very interesting. And I will refer to broadly about this, but I'm not going to give an account of what happened because we kind of basically know really the events that people started protesting in the streets, then eventually some dictatorship fell and it spread to other parts, then Libya got out of control, there was invasion, blah, blah, blah. We all know that. But I'll try to give an account by doing some political reflections that I think that could be interesting to spark some form of debate with the broader left and the revolutionary left and the anarchists in particular here in the context of this book fair. Okay, the first and most important thing, and I think it's necessary to take into account, is that, and I'll start taking a bit of the vision that came from the media, from the capitalist controlled media, that showed the Arab Spring as if it was something like unexpected. And in a way, it was unexpected, because no one was really had in mind that these protests that were happening could link together, could become so massive, and could engulf in flames the whole region in the way they did. Okay, actually, when I was on the way to Cairo, I stopped on London Heathrow, and I saw the Economist kind of special edition, what's 2011 going to be like. There was not even a mention of the Arabs, okay? And that was written in December, okay? The Arab world didn't exist, okay? Beyond, obviously, the fact that the peace process was going on between Fatah and Israel. That was the only kind of prediction that the bourgeoisie, at least the Economist, could do. So that shows to what extent they weren't expecting it. But they weren't expecting it because they don't realize the level of dissatisfaction that exists among the riffraff. They weren't expecting it because they don't see what's happening at the level of the people, at the level of the working class. Anyone who were following the news, and I'm talking just ordinary news of what was going on in Egypt, in Tunisia, and a number of other countries for the last 5-6 years, would have realized that actually there was an increase in the number of workers' struggles, that there were increasingly combative strikes, that there were a number of very militant actions sometimes of protest against the collaboration of a lot of the dictatorships with Zionism and with the oppression of the Palestinians. And all that really created a sense of unity and a sense of a spirit de corps between the Arab and North African people. And I want to say that it's a bit more complicated than that. It's not just the Arabs. It's more complicated, and I'll go into that in a while. But you could see it coming. And then you could see it coming also, because for the last 6 years, those economies had wonderful economic performances, okay? In spite of all, you couldn't say that the situation of the working class was steadily the situation, sorry, of the national economies was steadily deteriorating for the last 5 or 6 years. Actually, Egypt for the last 10 years had an average growth rate of 5%. So you're talking about economies, at least in macroeconomic terms, were doing all right. Now, obviously, what you don't see is how the situation and the standards of life of the working class are deteriorating. Okay, and that's why it's always misleading to read the economy only in terms of the figures and the statistics and the graphics and the red line down and the blue line up. Okay, so they couldn't see that. They couldn't see that the gap between rich and poor was widening. That there was wide dissatisfaction with that, and that obviously led to very contained and very specific workers' struggles. Some of them very militant, some of them very radical. But at the same time, it started undermining the legitimacy of the regimes. Okay, another factor of further undermining of the legitimacy of the regimes was the open collaboration with Zionism and with U.S. imperialism. I want to insist on that because legitimacy is something that is important even for a dictatorship. So obviously, all these factors were undermining it. Now, when food speculation started again now at the end of last year, because of a number of, we can talk about the food speculation cycle, you know, but that means that for the last time, the food prices have been escalating, you know, and that's been a precedent for revolt in different countries, in the Philippines, in Haiti, in Mexico, between the period 2006-2008, then the economic crisis hit. And that meant that Goldman Sachs and other speculators stopped speculating on food for the time being because they had to back their own investment in their own country. So they left this kind of market of speculation alone for a while, and that meant that the prices stabilized. But in 2010, because of the bailouts and because of the plans of economic recovery, they could start again speculating. That meant the price of food started skyrocketing again. And if you look at the protests in all of the Middle East, they started first because of the standards of life. They started first because of the price of bread in particular, but also the price of other staples, cooking oil, wheat, and so on and so forth. So, to a certain extent, one can say that even though the economies were performing all right, the economy played a huge part because of A, the increase in the spiraling, the spiraling in the price of livelihoods. But at the same time, because most of those economies, in particular in North Africa, for a long time have been economies that a huge part of their own economic activity was dependent on exporting clothes, exporting kind of things from the assembly industry, mainly apparel, to the European markets. When the European markets were hit by the crisis, obviously that had an impact as well on labor back in North Africa. At the same time, a lot of those countries, particularly Egypt, Tunisia, Algeria, depend to a great extent of the remittances sent by Arab immigrants living in Europe when they were left unemployed as well. That also had an impact on the standards of life in those countries that you couldn't see in terms of the economic performance, but basically you could sense in every single household in those countries. Okay, so that's giving a bit of a background in economic terms. So why they became mass movements for these two reasons: the steady deterioration of the conditions of the bulk of the population, a youth that is highly disaffected because it's in many cases very well educated with access to college and so on, but then they have titles that are useless because they don't find any job whatsoever in what they're doing, and that gives a great sense of the youth dimension of the mobilizations in particularly North Africa, and obviously because there is a genuine reason for protest with the veteran dictatorships that you had all over the region. And as I said, dictatorships that also were losing steadily their own legitimacy in their own home. Okay, so we're talking that with the Arab Spring, everything was there. All of the elements were there. to create mass movements that could challenge tyrannies that were thought to be eternal, that were thought to be solid as a rock. And again, I just remember that the only mention that Mubarak got in The Economist was in terms of how he would be a crucial factor in facilitating the peace process with Fatah and making sure that Palestinians behave rationally. Okay, that was more or less the kind of tone. So they were thought to be kind of pretty safe dictatorships. They thought that they were never going to be questioned. And the West and Europe and the US were all quite happily, merrily financing them, sending them guns, sending them support and all that. And then all of a sudden, the people come out to the street and, oh, we remember that we like democracy after all. And of course, we welcome their mobilization. And of course, we welcome that they fight against tyranny. And of course, we are on their side. Okay, but they didn't remember that 30 years earlier, so it was a bit too little, too late, and that's how most of the Arab people I've had the chance to talk with, particularly in Egypt, leave. It's a bit of a complicated issue. We'll come back to that, how they perceive the whole hypocrisy of the West, let's say, of the central capitalist economies. Mm-hmm. So. The youth movement was very important, and I want to go back to the media perception, at least in the West, as I say, the media perception of this being a movement of bloggers. Mm-hmm. Everywhere we saw that this was a kind of a new type of revolution, that this was kind of a novelty, that bloggers are somehow replacing now the importance of revolutionary organizations, of revolutionary ideologies, that Twitter has become a more effective weapon against tyranny than strikes, okay? So we're all supposed to believe this, okay? But I was talking with bloggers, actually, with very important, prominent bloggers in Egypt, you know, these young people, and they say, but that's absolute crap. And it's crap from one particular perspective. And he said, after the 55 of January, we had no internet, we have no mobile phone, and the protests kept growing and growing and growing. So obviously, how do you explain that? It wasn't a bloggers' revolution. It was not a Twitter revolution. It was not a Facebook revolution. Yeah, it's true. Among the youth, it was good to know each other first, to coordinate, to launch the initiative. But nothing could have happened if there wasn't an impact and a work at the grassroots level with the communities, with the workers. Okay, in the area of the Nile Delta and so on and so forth, that actually most of them don't have access to internet. So that's the way you want to see it, because obviously you want to take class struggle as a factor out of the equation, and you want to show that it's so virtual when it was actually a very real level of a struggle that wasn't built overnight. It's not the Facebook people just call for a demonstration now and it worked. It's been a process of 6-7 years of consistent struggle, of increasing militancy within the youth, and at the same time, and this was a very good point of a prominent blogger, Hossam El Harawi, that was talking, but he said, many times for the last 5 years I was calling for general strikes and mass mobilizations on Facebook. It wasn't just the first, it was the one of many, okay? This time it worked, and we were all surprised it worked, but it was all because everything came together. But it never worked before, so obviously it kind of undermines a bit that claim. But again, as I say, we all want to see postmodern revolutions, because those postmodern revolutions obviously take the riffraff out of the equation, and that's safe. Now, the other thing I want to say is, no matter the youth was important, the crucial factor was the importance of the working class, both in Tunisia and in Egypt, in terms of precipitating the fall of the regimes. And that was absolutely crystal clear. The people were systematically mobilizing in Egypt from the 25th of January, and probably, like in Yemen, they would still be mobilizing without much effect if on the 9th of February the trade union movement in Egypt wouldn't have called for a successful successful general strike against the regime. Give it 3 days, and the regime collapsed. Okay? So, again, this has been invisibilized by the international media, but everyone knows that the workers were actually crucial for the fall of the regime. Same in Tunisia. If the workers had not taken militant industrial action against the regime, probably they would still be protesting, as people, as I said, are still protesting in Bahrain, in Yemen, in Jordan, in many other countries. So it was a crucial factor that showed that in the 21st century, in spite of all the nonsense being said about the demise of the working class as a crucial actor in revolutions, they proved to be the determinant factor. Again, Hossam was saying something that's very interesting. In Egypt, the revolutionary movement started growing, and everything that happened since then and the youth movement started growing because of the growing levels of militancy of trade unions among the textile worker sector, the industrial sector in the Nile region. And there was a number of very strong and hardcore, I'd say, strikes with minor insurrections happening in Mahalla. That was the most famous case, but there was a number of others in Suez as well. That became a rallying point for most of the opposition at the time. Indeed, the youth movement that called for the protest on the 25th of January in Egypt was called the 6th of April Coalition. Does anyone know what the 6th of April represents in Egypt? Someone has to know.
The strike.
In 2008, the workers from Mahalla, from the textile worker sector, said, we're going to call for a national strike. That obviously didn't happen because of the conditions of the country, but was very combative anyway, and it translated into 1 week of systematic fighting, street fighting in the cities of the Delta that was very militant. And a lot of the youth then saw it and said, whoa, this is the way forward. And they formed the 6th of April coalition movement. And since then, they started calling a number of times for a general strike. As I said, didn't work. Now, the factors were there, and the revolution took place. Okay? So, the other thing I wanted to say, and I just want to talk about different reflections, and please do ask a lot of questions, because I think that it's more important to see what you want to know from it instead of me just articulating a grand discourse. So be bold at the end of my wee talk. We all talk about the Arab Spring, but the Arab Spring, it's been more than Arabs, and I think that's very important to bring to the attention. One of the first signs of unrest in the region actually didn't start with Arabs. Tunisia was important. But before Tunisia in December, in late November, sorry, you have the revolts in Morocco that were very radical of the Sahrawis, the people from the occupied Western Sahara that mobilized and had a lot of clashes with the security forces from Morocco. And that set the course for what would happen after. The Kurdish have had a very important role to play as well in the protest, particularly in Iraq. In Iraq, whatever protests have happened has been in the Kurdish region. And it's very interesting because it's Kurdish people that are supposed to enjoy an autonomous government, that are supposed to be to have had all of their quarrels satisfied and looked after for the last 8 years, and nonetheless they came out to complain against corruption, against lack of democracy, against lack of transparency, against collaboration, against same things the people were protesting in the north of Africa. In Syria as well, the protests started in the Kurdish areas of Syria in the northeast. Yeah, so you have the importance of them too. And then you have the Coptic Christians that, no matter they're Arabs, they're still seen as a different, almost ethnic group by other Egyptians that had a very strong role to play during the Tahrir Commune, as they call it. Okay, so you had a fair diversity there, and I say that it's safe to say that it's not just, I mean, Arab Spring, it's because of they represent the majority in the region. But it's safe to say that this has gone beyond sectarian lines, it's gone beyond ethnic lines, and it can reshape the whole it has the potential of reshaping the balance of forces and even the coexistence between different human groups in the region. Now, the big thing, and this is the real debate, it's what the people are protesting for, okay? There's a number of very clear social demands. As I said, the demand for bread, the demand for livelihoods, the demand for minimum income, for instance. Egypt doesn't have a minimum wage, so basically your boss can pay you whatever they want, and you can't do nothing about it legally. So now they're fighting to implement a minimum wage. All those are important struggles. At the same time, people say that they're fighting for democracy.
Now, democracy is an extraordinarily elastic word, and I want to be a bit more careful about what people mean for democracy, because it seems to be a very schizophrenic debate in the issue of democracy when you have imperialism saying by democracy, or given a certain version of it, when the people in the popular committees were given a different version of it, and while the people in the military ranks and the people in the bourgeois ranks were given yet another version of it. So I think that the very concept of democracy, it's becoming now a very contentious issue, particularly in the countries that toppled their dictators, and that's mainly Tunisia, probably Yemen's to follow soon, but mainly Tunisia and Egypt, okay? It was interesting that Obama was doing his tour in Latin America at the time that Mubarak fell, and of course he was very happy about it, so he said, even though he said he was a great leader for the Egyptian people just in September the year before, but he seemingly changed his mind very quickly. He said, well done, Egyptian people, that shows that the values of the USA are universal and you want your share of democracy as well, you want to be more like us, so that's great, we're really glad that at last you're asking for democracy, we're willing to give it to you all these years, so you can have it now. But now if you want to talk about democracy and be serious about it, because of course we know we like democracy, but not too much democracy, you have to look at the example of the transition in Chile. And that was very interesting, because the transition to democracy in Chile is an extraordinary case of a successful imperialist-led and invigilated democratic transition from a fascist dictatorship to a fascist democracy. Now I'm just exaggerating with the F word there, but from a pretty rough, basically a neoliberal military ruthless dictatorship to a pretty rough form of democracy. Even though Pinochet himself was a great admirer of the Nazis, I declined to call him a Nazi because Hitler at least had a mass movement behind him. Okay, Pinochet only had the army. So, coming back to this issue, I don't know if you're familiar with the Chilean model of transition to democracy, but it worked really well for imperialism. It worked really well for the Chilean bourgeoisie because we have now, as we say, the right to elect every 6 years a new dictator. We have a transition to democracy, but few people would know that still we have a National Security Council. A National Security Council is a fourth organ of state, so usually democratic states would have a judicial, parliament, a legislative, it's called, and an executive. Okay, what they're called counterinsurgency states have an executive, a legislature, and they have a judiciary, but also they have a National Security Council that it's an organ that brings together the executive, in the Chilean case, the Catholic Church, and the army. Okay, so it's a pretty nice combination, and they have a say over all of the other forms of state. The fact why they haven't invoked it more often over the last 20-odd years of invigorated democracy is because they haven't had any need of it. I'm going to go back why they haven't had any need, but in the meantime, let's say that they just haven't had the need. So we have the National Security Council. Another measure of how successful the transition to democracy was is that in Chile still you have the 1980 constitution. Whether you believe it or not, still this democracy has the dictatorship designed by Pinochet and a couple of pals, and it has been almost untouched, save some cosmetic changes, and usually to make it even worse than what it was back in 1980, particularly in labor rights. Okay? Then you have that the economic model was maintained. Okay, we have still the same economic model, in spite of talking so much about the freedom of the market, was created in the most authoritarian conditions for people that you can think of. And you have as well a kind of electoral system that really doesn't allow for third options to appear or to prosper in any form in the electoral process. So we have pretty much a two-party system like the one they have in the US, which means basically that everything changes so nothing changes. Interestingly enough, when the right wing won the last elections, everyone was saying, oh, this is going to be terrible, fascism is going to be back in power, and you just are surprised how smoothly everything has gone. It's just the same thing happening, and I'm not exaggerating, I'm not being extraordinarily sectarian. It's true. It's true. If you ask to anyone, their life hasn't changed in any significant condition. It's not to say that the right wing is any good, but to say how bad the official left is. Now, that's the kind of model that's been peddled as a democratic example to the Egyptians. So when I was there, everyone was asking me, so how does how does this system work? And I was, it was bound to disappoint them when I was saying it, because I was saying, yeah, it's basically that everything changes, so nothing changes. I mean, the US and imperialism, you have to understand, they have no friends. All they have, it's common interests. So they will support dictatorship as long as dictatorship is serving a purpose for them, and then they will jump into a democratic jargon as long as as long as democracy can be a benefit for them as well. Of course, as I'm saying, very limited forms of democracy. Now, so they were quick to dump Mubarak, they were quick to dump even Gaddafi, that he was the best of pals of them since 2003 at least, but even before that, negotiations started around 97, 98. Because obviously he was serving no further purpose for them, so they got rid of him, and they're promoting this form of democracy. In Tunisia, they're giving to civil society groups over $25 million in terms of training about how to implement a number of economic reforms, how to implement a number of legislative measures. So obviously it's very clear that what they want to do is two things. A, make sure that whatever form of democracy emerges, it's fully respectful of the hegemony of the US in the region, so oil can keep flowing and so on and so forth. And the second thing is that the economic model is not altered in any significant form. And that's all really they care. About the rest, they don't give a damn. And even, I was just saying, someone, they could be really willing to give up Israel if it wasn't for the fact that Israel is by far the most reliable support they have in the region. But if it became a nuisance at any point, they would be quick to get rid of them. But don't do it because of the extraordinary level of loyalty they have with the US. So they have no friends, and that's a sad way to live, but it's a way that brings massive profit. So that's their type of democracy. Now, every time that there's a revolutionary process, what happens is that the traditional mechanisms of how society work and society is run collapses. That's the first thing. I mean, everything collapses. So all of a sudden, you want to take the bus, but there's no bus. All of a sudden, you want to watch television, but there's no electricity, and all those kind of things happen. So people have to respond to this, what some people call vacuums of power. I don't know if the expression is used in English, but in Spanish we say vacío de poder. Vacuum of power. No, you're a good bilingual man. Now, you have this... Trilingual. You're amazing. So you have a power vacuum, okay? And that's the main characteristic of any revolution. And then when you have a power vacuum, there's one thing that people can cope with, and it's uncertainty. So people organize, people do things together, and one of the main things that people do is security. Because when there's a power vacuum, people feel vulnerable, people feel weak, people feel isolated. And I think that as anarchists, we shouldn't overlook the need for security of the people, because we often do. And that's a big mistake. A lot of the most radical experiences of self-organization actually start as self-defense groups. And that was the case, for instance, in Tunisia, that was the case in Egypt. And we really have to look into that. But then from just looking for security numbers and feeling that power vacuum, like, I mean, dealing with traffic and simple stuff like that, they move into articulating the demands of the population, okay? So immediately the People's Committee started discussing politics, and they realized that, well, it's nice to meet your neighbors, it's nice to come together with them, it's nice to discuss common problems, because actually we have the same problems, it's not just me. Okay, there's a number of us, and there's a number of collective responses we can bring together, and that's the beautiful thing that happened with experiences of direct democracy. And as I said, they happen all over the place. Look at Ukraine, look at Spain, look at North Korea in the 45. Everywhere they happen. Okay, this people's committee. It's not novelty from the Arab world, and it only shows that for all the Orientalist temptation that we've had been that we have been fed for the last 10 years of war on terror, Arab people are no different to any of us in the most fundamental, at the most fundamental human level. Of course, very different culturally, and they have a right to be different, and we have a right to respect that and we should be respecting the difference. But fundamentally, in their own humanity, they're as rational, as loving, as caring as any of us. So all this image of the turban animal willing to blow up you and your little children kind of collapses when you see that they react actually like normal, ordinary people. I can't emphasize that too much because of the high doses of racism that we constantly get day and night on the Western media, particularly in Europe and the US. It's sickening, sickening. So they realized other forms of democracy. It was with the People's Committees, and it was very interesting, a meeting in Giza, that it's a popular neighborhood where the pyramids are. So it was very interesting being there in the People's Committee, because the pyramids were there, and they're impressive. But the interesting thing is that they've been there for so long that you think that it's a country that nothing ever changes, that and all of a sudden you are confronted a couple of blocks down with a very changing situation. Someone said to me, Egypt is the oldest country in the world, but at the same time it's the youngest country if you look at the demographics, and it's true. I mean, 60-70% of the population is under 28. It's kind of massive. It's a crazy number. So there you are in Giza with people experimenting a new form of democracy, and all of a sudden they start discussing. And what they were discussing was like the articulation with the other people's committees on the country. And it was very interesting because the people committees were formed in different neighborhoods belonging to different classes. Now, in the middle classes, the people's committees were seen more as a nuisance, as something they had to do, but they really didn't want to do, because there's no police, there's no this, there's no that, and we have to kind of fill that power vacuum somehow. So people came together, but as soon as things went back to normal, they were quick to abandon them and send them to hell and say, we don't want that anymore. But in the popular neighborhoods, it was different, because they realized this hidden power that people have when they come together, hand in hand, as the old lovely song said. So they were discussing about coordination. They were discussing as well about limiting in the neighborhood the price of food, which shows you that's pretty much at the root of all the unrest in Egypt in particular, but all over the Arab world. And at the same time, they were discussing about electing the local representatives directly through the people's committees. So it's very interesting, because it says that in one way or another, the people's committees acknowledge themselves as an alternative form of power, and that they don't acknowledge the state in terms of, we don't want the state to appoint local representatives here, but it's not even that we want to vote them directly, because even if you vote them directly, you're going through the state institution anyway. We want to elect them through the people's committees. So we show that this is our space, this is how we're in control. So it was a very, very interesting thing, and that shows that there's a new model of democracy there. It's a very old model of democracy, because, as I said, look at the Paris Commune, it's exactly the same, and it comes time and again when the people rebel against their oppressors. And there again, it's the transition government. You have the military junta and the bourgeoisie that have kind of ambivalent positions, because on the one hand, they have to concede to people's demands, they have to concede to give concessions to the pressure from below, while at the same time they are trying to make sure that everything remains pretty much the same. So if you look, all of the big concessions being won since the fall of Mubarak, like for instance the dismantling of the secret police, the trial to the detention of Mubarak and his family, and the trials to some prominent members of the regime, all did come after huge mass struggles, particularly the 8th and 9th of April. I mean, you had again 1 million people coming to Tahrir saying to the junta, listen, we want here some limits to this. This is going nowhere. We are upset and so on and so forth. And voila, Prime Minister was out, Mubarak was detained. Things can happen when people mobilize. And I think that the Egyptian working class, Egyptian people, the Egyptian folks in general, are generally aware of this power and they're willing to exercise it. And a lot of people have asked me, and I want to conclude with this, and then I'm all ears for questions and answers and remarks. Whenever I've talked about the Arab revolutions, people say, oh, but there are no revolutions because the property has not changed, the means of production are still in the hands of the capitalists. And even that's questionable because in Tunisia, actually, there's been a lot of factory occupations and even mine occupations that are very radical and people don't know about it. In Egypt, you have a growing as well movement for the occupation of factories. And they're not happening, as in Argentina, in factories that are bankrupt. They're happening in perfectly healthy factories and enterprises and workplaces. And there's been a huge struggle as well for the renationalization of some enterprises that were privatized by Mubarak. So a lot of people have said, yeah, well, nothing major has happened. We don't have socialism, because you obviously tend to believe that socialism is this kind of magic solution to everything, but you don't see the process. And what has happened, and why you say there's been a revolution, is because something magic and something fundamental and something crucial and something extraordinarily beautiful happened in those countries. And it's very beautiful when you see it. Actually, more than once I cried out of happiness when I was in Egypt about certain things I saw and heard, okay? Like, for instance, a young man from the Muslim Brotherhood saying to me, oh, in Tahrir I met for the first time a Christian brother, and I loved him so much. He was just like my brother. He reminded me of him, and he was shivering in emotion. You know? When that happens, you know, there's magic there, and that's beautiful. When you see the women coming out and saying, we're not taking this, we're not taking that, we want to be actors as well of our own struggle. When you see the women participating in the people's committees, not only in equal numbers, but sometimes more women than men, it's a beautiful thing. When you see them reclaiming their life to exist, to be someone, to deliver it, it's a beautiful thing. And I think that those who say that there's been no revolution fail to see the beauty of what's going on. And they fail to see that the fundamental change was that ultimately the balance of forces in class struggle changed, shifted. And now it's definitely on the side of the working class, and that's why our brothers and sisters in the Arab world need and demand our solidarity in all forms, because we have a tough struggle ahead. The situation is fluid. It could go either way. They could impose a Chilean model of transition, but also workers could topple the system. And it's a possibility. It's not going to happen tomorrow. It's not going to happen in a month. But then who would have said in December that Mubarak would fall? But it is happening. It's moving. And it's moving forward. And it's moving in the right direction, in the left direction, I should say. And that's all I want to say. So if you want to come to with questions and all that, I'm all ears.
Okay, so I'm going to open it up the floor for discussion and questions and comments and so on.
Question one, and also I guess, just to what extent, is sectarian division actually hitting the working class in Egypt? Because there's been some worrying things, all right. Like, obviously someone is stirring that up. It's not actually coming from nowhere. Some of the reports, all right, suggest, you know, like in the more extreme, now not the Muslim Brotherhood, but some of the more extreme elements, are coming out now and becoming active. Fundamentalists are actually becoming active in Egypt. I mean, how strong is that? Could that, is it possible that could derail actually and divide the working class?
That's a very long question. So before taking Ronan your question, is it linked to that? Because I prefer it actually to.
It's about Palestine.
Excellent. Go for it.
Yeah. Can you talk about the attitude of the activist Jeanette towards the Palestinian state and they expect from the upcoming government, the Egyptian government, how they'll handle the situation in Palestine?
I'll take those two, and then it's Sue and Paul. And Wayne. Okay, I'll start with the sectarian divisions. They do exist. They're very strong. Okay, and they've been stimulated by the state for the last 50, 60 odd years. Okay, there's been a number of... there's a legal discrimination of Christians in particular. There are minorities, some 10% of the population. So they're a significant minority, underrepresented in the census and so on. But the interesting thing, because what you see, it's the sectarian struggle, okay, that it's a relatively new thing. Again, I want to say that the relationship of Christians and Muslims in Egypt in particular and elsewhere have been relatively good historically. There's no long-standing tradition of infighting within the communities, say for the last 50 or 60 years, okay? And we're talking about our religions of 2,000 years, so you can say it's a fairly new phenomenon. Now, that was obviously linked to the nastiest aspects of Arab nationalism, even more than Islamic fundamentalism, if you want to call it like that, called political Islam. That was a largely relevant factor until the 70s and so on. I'm going to go back to that. The big clashes started happening for the last 10 years, okay? There's been some massacres, very sporadic anyway. It's not kind of a systematic thing, but whenever they happen, they're very nasty. Clashes with Molotovs and so on. This week they burned... They burned two churches. They killed some 12 Christian cops. Okay, so it is a nasty thing. No one seems to like it, but again, I think that some discourses that are out there are feeding into that. For instance, the Muslim Brotherhood are not openly saying we welcome this, but when they say things like we should put a special revive this medieval tax to infidels, you know, obviously they're feeding into that and they're steering that kind of rotten pot. Now. Again, how strong it is, I'd say that, relatively speaking, it's not as strong as those who are willing for unity. What you see, and I think it still fits pretty well with the racist kind of media bias that want to show Muslim people in particular as wild animals that are willing to eat Christian children, do you know what I mean? It fits very well, so they see this violence and they see it. But wherever you walk in Cairo, you see the crescent with the cross as a graffiti put together. A lot of flags took out, and you see them in the balconies, and I brought a lot of photographs of that because I thought it was remarkable. Took the eagle out. The eagle is kind of the traditional emblem in the Egyptian flag, and put the crescent and the cross together, calling for a non-sectarian approach to a common struggle. Everyone spoke about that there's movements for the unity and the mutual respect, the mutual understanding, and I think that's not shown in the international media, even though it's a very important movement, because it doesn't feed well into this kind of general discourse that basically Muslims are terrorists and they're bad people and they have to be kept on bay. It's very interesting at the same time to see that within the credos themselves, there's been a change. I mean, I told you this story about this young Muslim brother, but also all of the youth wing of the Muslim Brothers split with the Muslim Brothers in March, and they split over a number of questions that are absolutely taboo for them, like, for instance, why the Muslim Brothers don't have any female representation in the leadership. Okay, those questions were done by the youth that actually saw women fighting on Tahrir, and they say, well, why don't they have a space? They said, the Muslim Brothers said, we're going to form our own political party. And the youth movement was saying, but why do we have to form it along sectarian Islamic lines? Why can't we do a chair initiative with Christian cops as well and make sure that we have a representation from Christian cops? Okay, what happens to the youth? All this, it's happening at the level particularly of the youth. I mean, a man like this man I'm talking about, you know, when he's going to be told, listen, we want things that Coptic man who reminded you of your brother has to pay a special tax because he's an infidel, he's going to give the two fingers. He's going to say, no way, he's my brother. Okay? And that change happened. People prayed together in Tahrir. Not few, millions of people. Okay? And yeah, we can see that we're no gods, no master, the religion, but that was a deeper message. And the message there was that no matter what background you come from, you're welcome here. And at the same time, as I say, religion is so important in shaping your culture, your background and everything, that a lot of people see religion as an ethnic thing. I kept asking people, do you have any national minorities in Egypt? And say, oh yeah, the Christian Copts. And I was like, no, that's a religious minority. Oh, no, but they're so different. You should see them. You should know them. They're very, very different people to us. So that shows you to what extent it's seen as something, as something important. And bridging this is important. On the side of the Christians as well, it's a very traditional, yes, you might know, I mean, Christianity is no better in many ways. It's a very traditional community too, okay? An intermarriage with people from other credos, it's vetoed, and there's kind of a big thing there as well. But when I was there, there was these people that were interested in launching their own Coptic version of the liberation theology. The liberation theology, for those of you who don't know, was a dissident sector of the Catholic Church in Latin America in the 60s that said that socialism, the message of Christianity was basically socialism, and they had to bring faith and politics together from a progressive point of view, not from the point of view, obviously, of an extraordinarily reactionary and backward right-wing agenda. So this was interesting. They said, and when we formalize our liberation theology Coptic trend, the most important thing for us is starting an ecumenical dialogue with the Muslims. Okay, and that was interesting. That was very interesting. And I was talking with the anarchists there, very enlightened comrades, very smart comrades, and they said, listen, if we fall into the trap of militant atheism, we're crazy here, we're not going to reach anyone. And at the same time, we have to create a bridge and we have to start a dialogue with the progressive sectors within Islam. And make sure, yes, we anarchists, we women, we gay people, we're not Satan. And you realize we're not Satan because you met us on Tahrir. I will meet in the future struggle. So that's very important. I want to say, I don't want to deny the existence of those divisions and that they can be very nasty. But my view of it, and it's a view shared with other Egyptian militants, is that since Tahrir made political Islam largely irrelevant, it was marginal. And even people that are in the Muslim Brotherhood participated on a personal capacity. So immediately after, to agitate and polarizing along sectarian lines is their way as well to be relevant in a post-Mubarak context. Okay? And in a way to put order in the ranks against the all the splits that they're having. Because they were kept under pressure all these years. Pressure was gone and boom, they exploded. That's more or less what happened. Now, in relation to Palestine, the Egyptian people love the Palestinians, okay, on a number of grounds, not only because they're in the border, not only because they have a refugee community, but at the same time because they have a deep sense of shame of how they've cooperated for years with the collective punishment on Gaza and on the occupation project in particular for a period a bit longer since the Camp David agreement in the 70s. Now, it's interesting, talking with people linked to the FPLP in, that's the acronym in Spanish, how is the acronym in English? PFLP, okay. Yeah. They were saying to me, because the junta don't want things to change too much, they need to do some concessions. And Palestine is a concession. You can't underestimate how important the Palestinian question was to take away legitimacy to Mubarak and to Sadat before him, okay? You can't underestimate how strongly the Palestinian cause is felt among them. You can't underestimate that the first political school to a lot of Arabs is solidarity with Palestine. And that teaches them the real nature of the Arab political system, that teaches them about the real nature of imperialism and so on and so forth. You can't underestimate it. So obviously opening the Rafah border is kind of in a kind of limbo situation now, but opening the situation, having been a bona fide actor in promoting the reconciliation, whatever that means, that's another debate between Hamas and Fatah, It's also part of the same. And the fact, if you think in March, there were some Qassam rockets thrown to Israel and Israel started bombing, the Minister of Defense immediately warned Israel that this time there were going to be repercussions. And they stopped. So Israel knows that the scenario is not the same. Israel knows that they have to be more cautious. Operation Castlet's not going to happen again. It can't happen because the people is empowered, and the people in Egypt, their cause is the cause of Palestine, and they will come out. I know that it's Israel can always surprise you with their level of brutality and political insensitivity, but I think that they're going to be far more cautious than they were ever before. They're not going to be into heavy bombing again that easily, and I would be very interested to see what's going to happen tomorrow with the call for the third intifada, okay, when the people that have been displaced, the refugees, will go to the border, and that probably will force Egypt to act actually and open the Rafah border. And what will happen in Israel and in the occupied territories with a new uprise of the Palestinians. We'll see what happens. But it's going to be an interesting conflict, because whatever happens tomorrow will set the course to how much the Egyptian government is going to be willing to deliver in terms of the Palestinians. Paul, Wayne, this fine gentleman.
So, call on you, then Paul, Wayne, yourself, sir, and then yourself. I've asked all people to keep contributions fairly short because we've only got about half an hour left before we have to be out of here.
And short responses as well. Sorry.
I just wanted to ask you about the army, the way that they have an awful lot of power at the moment, and they have some of them did join in Times Square, or and also I've read on Al Jazeera, like, they're really trying to squash the whole strikes, because there's strikes going on everywhere, but some they don't, and some they do, you know what I mean? And do you think when the elections happen in the autumn, will the army actually, you know, step aside, or will they try and stay?
Really, it's a revolution. Anybody said it's not a revolution because it doesn't meet my, you know, wallet goals, as talking to his hat. But it's an unfinished revolution. Mm-hmm. And my question that is to be finished would involve such things as the workers actually occupying and taking over industry and coordinating industry and split up and break up of the army. Workplace neighborhood councils. Obviously, this is not something that's happening at the moment. This is my tendency towards it. So I wanted to know what you spoke with some anarchists, and I'm hoping for a little bit more about how many, you know, are you talking about three people in a crowd of Marines, or are there some kind of organized tendency or something? And what are they doing in order to get the revolution beyond the unfinished?
So I think I'll go with those questions. At the end with the two of you. So I'll try to be very as brief as I can. I'm not going to say very brief. I'll say as brief as I can. The army is basically a bourgeois institution, like anywhere, and there are the people that have been in power since 1952. From that perspective, things have not changed. Okay, they still remain they still have the upper hand. And yes, they have implemented a number of very regressive measures, like the militarization of a number of the militarization of a number of public spaces, including Tahrir. May Day was interesting because May Day was an explosion of freedom in a way. Okay, you saw the hammer and the sickle being waved in the streets of Cairo for the first time since 1924. What gives you a sense of how relevant it was, okay? People were all speaking, they were all talking about the revolution, Saura, Saura. But yet again, you had that space of freedom, but it was very confined because we were surrounded by the army with Kalashnikov. So it was very graphic, the role that the army is playing. The anti-strike law was one of the first laws they passed, and again, anytime the counter-revolution imposes itself, it happened in Ireland, happened everywhere, it's the first law they passed, okay? So keeping the workers at shop floor level online, again, that shows how central the working class as such is. The anti-strike law, though, it's been ineffective. Strikes are happening. Struggle is happening. There's a curfew as well. And I can tell you something. I was hanging around the streets of Cairo at 2 o'clock in the morning and no one bothered me. So, again, it's a situation where a lot of things have been decreed. But again, the capacity and the power they have to implement a lot of their reactionary plan, it's quite limited in real terms. So you have on the one hand the judicial and the kind of state framework, and on the other hand you have the balance of forces at the level of the class struggle. And that makes the situation very fluid, and I'm going to jump from that to what Wayne was saying. Yes, it is an unfinished revolution. It is still going on. There's new elements happen. It's a very fluid situation. The workers are pushing for occupations. The workers are pushing for independent organization. The people's committees want to to transform themselves into a local form of self-government. All that's happening. It's not going to grow mathematically, and revolutions don't happen like that. It's not that you left them untouched and eventually they'll grow up, as you were talking earlier on about this reformist kind of strategy, you know, that's even omnipresent among anarchists in terms of saying, like, oh yeah, you do your alternative thing and eventually you'll topple the state. All these have to be in touch with the political climate, what's happening in Egypt, and how that's going to, and how the struggle on the street is going to affect the situation. So these experiences can actually give revolutionary leaps forward, okay? So yes, these experiences exist, they're resisting, they're growing in some ways, but they have to be very careful to articulate it with the resistance to the general reactionary onslaught against worker rights. The position of our anarchist comrades is actually very nuanced, and it's build a revolutionary front with other sectors in the current context, sectors that oppose the military junta, that oppose the going back to normal business, people that want the empowerment from below of these initiatives. And there is a fair amount of people that are not necessarily labeled anarchists that believe in that. So there is a common ground. At the same time, because of Mubarak, it's interesting because a few people said openly that I'm an anarchist. There were just two, actually, before Mubarak fell. And after Mubarak fell, a number of others appeared. Yeah, we knew it through Facebook, but I was scared to say it because I didn't know who you were. I didn't know if you were a state agent. So they're in a process of getting to know one another. Many of them met for the first time in Tahrir because they didn't want to arrange a personal face-to-face meeting before because of obvious reasons, security reasons. Many of them met actually now on May Day, not even in Tahrir because it was so much people, met on May Day for the first time. So those are more or less the positions. They do think they have to become increasingly relevant. They say, listen, if we don't address what's going to happen in September with the next elections, and we really have to have a voice there in terms of denouncing what's happening, but trying to tie our political position, our political calendar to what's happening in the kind of national agenda, we're going to be hopeless. Okay, so I thought it was a very interesting bunch. And actually, Wayne, I'm going to say that Jasser Abdullah, one of the main comrades there, said that in him you had the biggest fan probably on earth. They read your articles and they quite like them, and they say, good on you that there's someone from there that takes anti-imperialism seriously, because it's a genuine quarrel they have against international anarchist movement, that they don't think Palestine sometimes, they don't think that anti-imperialism is taken seriously. And I want to say that, and I want to stress that, and you got actually a very good rating from that perspective. So if you're ever going to go to Cairo, you're going to be received as a kind of guru or king. Sorts.
Yeah. Anarchist king.
Pharaoh. The anarchist pharaoh. Now, coming back to the issue of the women's movement, okay? The women's movement developed over the last while through NGOs, largely. But that, again, you have to understand it from the point of view that there was no space for independent organization. So really, women's organizations were increasingly harassed, not only by Mubarak, okay, but also by this increasing tendency in conservative Islam. But funnily enough, And I want to go back to your point, Pat. A lot of people are saying after the fall of Mubarak, Islam is suddenly increasingly growing and exploding, and it's not true. It's not true. Its growth has actually deaccelerated. Now, what happened is that because there's not the media censorship there used to be before, they're visible, okay? But the real period of growth of political Islam was under Mubarak, indeed. And Tahrir, in one way or another, put an end to the process. So now, coming back to this, for 10 years, the women's movement, particularly the NGOs, was the safest space they had to meet and to struggle, saw themselves quite harassed on two fronts, by the institutions and by the growth of Salafism and the Wahhabis, and particularly nasty and conservative tendencies within Islam, okay, that by no means are majority, but still they're very loud, to put it somehow. The women's movement is very interesting because a lot of the feminists actually wear the hijab. So it's very interesting that a lot of the debate that we have here or as we see the feminist struggle in Arab countries, it's really undermined by the reality of Arab countries themselves. I went to a pub and you see women with the hijab drinking beer on their own. You're not expecting that. You see a woman all in black, like Iran style, holding a hammer and a sickle. And you just go like, no, listen, there's something here I'm not quite getting. And then I talked with one of them, a journalist, a very articulate feminist, who said to me, yeah, what happened is that the important thing is not what you have over your head, but what you have inside your head. And obviously, in the West, you don't want to see, because you're imperialist and patriarchal, you don't want to take us seriously and you don't want to see what's going on there. I mean, what's your version of women's liberation? Okay, that we have to go to the hairdresser. I never go to the hairdresser. I just put my hijab and I'm fine, is it? That we have to wear a lot of makeup, that we have to expose our own. So with hijab or without hijab, you always want to see us as objects. You know, and we reject that, and we will dress whatever way we dress. We don't care about that. The important thing is what's going on inside our head. The important thing is that we don't have a veil on our mind. And I thought that was very assertive. That was very good, and it really put everything, all the debate, in perspective. So 8th of March was a very small demo. Same as May Day was small because there's no tradition of doing those demos. It's the first to happen, and hopefully next 8th of March we have, with hijab or without hijab, more and more women coming out and demanding their rights and facing and trying to make sure that the post-Mubarak Egypt not only gives a better hearing to women, but actually where women are empowered by themselves and by their own struggle and from below.
Okay, so I'm going to take yourself and then yourself.
Would you agree with the Bush set these prisons up with Arab state participation in these ghost prisons in these countries? But these countries then use the war on terror to maintain their own dictatorships and to oppress the Muslims. Would you agree?
Okay, and then yourself, sir.
Response about Israel. You said that you think, you know, because of the mobilization in Egypt, that means the caste-led can't or won't happen again. And the reason I disagree with that is because I think what's one of the most striking things, I think, in the development of, in recent developments in Egypt and the Arab world more generally, is this upsurge in popular democracy, which you're talking about. But then against that, you have Israel retrenching. And in a very anti-democratic way. So I think so long as they believe they can rely on the economic support of the United States, that policy, at least in the short term.
Mm-hmm.
But the other two points where I think I agree with you more, the other two points were first that a question, if you could put on your anarchist revolutionary strategist hat for a moment and reflect on on the relationship between the popular mobilizations in Egypt and the relationship with the relationship between the popular mobilizations in Egypt and the military. What can we learn from the way that's played out? And the third point or question is, and this is another, I suppose, classic anarchist issue or dilemma, is spontaneity versus organization. You talked about the portrayal of the Arab Spring and the Egyptian Spring in particular in the Western media, and it's been portrayed as a very spontaneous movement. That's been emphasized in academic accounts insofar as they're appearing as well. And so my question is, do you think that those portrayals are accurate? I have my own views on this, but I mean, are those portrayals accurate? And what levels of organization did you see during the time that you visited Egypt?
Whoa. Those are very big questions. But, yeah, first of all, extraordinary rendition flights and all that. I think that certainly it's going to be more difficult for the regimes now to implement them, particularly where they've lost, where dictatorships have been toppled. I mean, not only dictatorships were toppled, but at the same time, the security apparatus of Egypt was disbanded through people's pressure. Now, I'm not saying with that they won't try to create in the next coming months their own new security apparatus, but that means it's going to be a realignment of allegiances, a realignment of a new, more realistic assessment of forces, was going to have an influence into how they've been collaborating with imperialism for the last 10 or so years. They will not be able to be that open anymore. A lot of the security compounds and detention centers were invaded by the people. Security files were burned or shredded. So it's an interesting one from that perspective and from that point of view. I'm afraid that I'm not too much of an expert in this, so I'm not going to see anything else.
Do you think they used the war on terror though as an excuse to maintain their dictatorships for the last decade?
It's a complicated question. Because I think that they used it to increase their extraction and their looting of resources in the Middle East. That's beyond question, okay? They did it because of a changing balance as well in geostrategic forces, the emergence of new dynamic centers of capitalism for the last 15 or so years. So there's a number of geostrategic and very crass, earthy economic reasons behind it. Okay, and the war on terror, I mean, it's never been genuine. The war on terror, it's an ideological device to justify and make acceptable to us the non... non-Arabs and non-Muslim to make acceptable a new economic, a new military adventure at a time that we were supposed to have been at the end of history, that there was no evil empire, etc., etc., etc. I think that capitalism necessarily leads to war. And war is not because they're just bad or they want to bomb people, but it's because there is a fight over the share of the cake. And that's what it is at the end of the day. Likewise, they don't care about Israel because of Israel as such. They care about Israel because it's their main pillar to keep the region under control. Okay? So I'm coming back to the issue of what I meant when I said that Castlet would happen. I'm not saying that they couldn't, that Israel is never again going to surprise us with their level of atrocity and brutality. I'm not saying that they won't ever again probably use white phosphorus. What I'm saying is that Castlet was very wanton in terms of how you start a war. And they'll never be as wanton again. I think that they will be far more cautious. And certainly March demonstrated that they could, that Egypt had some power to restrain them to a certain extent. Again, as long as they had the atomic weapon, they could do whatever. But still, I think that we have to understand that they can't act in the same way they used to before. And that has definitely changed. We'll see, as I said, we'll see with whatever happens now on the 15th with the start of the third intifada, so have to keep an eye on that. Secondly, about popular democracy in Israel, as I said, the Egyptian people genuinely like Palestine, genuinely are for the Palestinian cause, and therefore they're exercising indirectly through Egypt some pressure over Israel. And the United States at the same time has to be more careful, because as I said, they don't care about, they don't have a, I mean, Israel as such is not what they care. What they care is the bleeding oil. And Israel is important because it's a settler colonial model that actually ensures that you have a pretty reliable population to act as a gendarme at any time. So the Israel has to balance their interest in satisfying Israel or keeping Israel happy, while at the same time make sure that the Arab countries, which are largely the oil-producing countries, are not alienated by their decisions. So the United States, and I think that that's another source of pressure apart from Egypt and the own Arab people's revolts, that's another source of pressure for Israel to be a bit more restrained, that the U.S. probably will have to make some concessions to the new Arab regimes to show that, yeah, after all, they're not that bad, and to make the regimes save face in front of the Iran population. Now, what can we learn in terms of popular mobilization and the army? There's a very, I think that there's just one big demonstration, I mean, one big lesson. And the lesson is that the army was not won through appeasement, but the army was won through the actual defiance and challenge of the people. It's not that even the army was not won, but at least they didn't repress. And some sectors, yes, in the mid-ranks and all that, genuinely sided with the people. Okay, but that happened because the people appeared strong and the people were daring to go out there and struggle. Again, that shows that we have to be, if we want to win in decisive sectors for the revolution, we have to be even more vocal about the revolution instead of trying to sweeten their taste with a bit of reformist and constraint slang here and there and circumspect talk. And last but not least, spontaneity. That's a big question. I referred to some example, I'll repeat myself. It wasn't spontaneous from the point of view that people did not start fighting overnight. There was at least, since 2005, there was an unprecedented level of militancy in the working class in those countries. There was an unprecedented level of political violence in protests, in demonstrations, in strikes. Okay, if you think a strike like Mahala in 2008 couldn't even happen here in Europe, because it would be, Jesus Christ, unseen since the Bavarian Republic. Okay, so we're talking about a real high intensity level of a struggle. So from that point of view, it would be inaccurate to say that the struggles were spontaneous. But at the same time, they were spontaneous from the point of view that there was genuine and legitimate anger out there that was largely non-organized. Most of the people came to the streets, and in the streets were creating their own organizations along the way. Now, the big challenge put forward by a spontaneous organization is that usually they take the form of interim measures. They take the form of emergency organizations while capitalism goes back to normal. So we saw it in Argentina, people form committees, people form this, people form that, organized horizontally from the grassroots. But when capitalism stabilized, people went back and everything went back to normal. And that's the role of anarchists. And I can't take the hat, sorry, I tried to, but eventually I capitulate to my own ideological convictions. That's the role of anarchists. The role of anarchists is make sure people, listen, these are your political capacities, that's what you can do. That's how life could be different. What we have to make sure is that this new form of democracy you're building, that this new form of life, is not just an interim measure, but we see strategically in the long term, and we create something permanent, something solid out of this. We use it as an alternative, that we believe in our capacity to kick out bosses, to kick out the army, to kick out the bourgeoisie, to kick out oppressors, to kick out patriarchy. But we have to believe in that capacity. And obviously, when you don't have too much of a space for revolutionary politics, people just behave that way. Feel the power vacuum, then go back home. And we have to make sure that people this time don't go back home. Stay out there.
Okay, we have time for just one more quick question. So, okay, I'll take you.
Just in support of what you were saying about opposing the perspective of people who have this model of revolution as like a business transaction, where you sign on a bottom line and the means of production are suddenly transferred in day one, the army are out of power, etc. I think a symptom of the fact that something very revolutionary has begun is the peculiar situation of Syria at the moment. With the exception of the Syrian people, Bashar Assad has never had so many friends. Because not only are his traditional allies, the Iranians and Hezbollah in Lebanon and Hamas as well, that he's had a relationship with for a long time in support of Assad, but also the Turkish, because they're afraid of Kurdistan, and the Saudis, because of the threat of destabilization. Even the Israelis.
Yeah. Even the Israelis.
Even the Israelis. Now, what possible force could lead Israel and Iran to be on the same side today in supporting Assad, if not fear of the revolution?
Yeah. Danny Yatom, the ex-head of Mossad, said it. We don't want to see this instability because we don't know what's going to happen. And we don't know how the Israeli people will react, he said. And we don't know what's going to happen in the end. We don't know what's going to happen with the Palestinians. So, therefore, we just think that the Arab Spring shook up, got the message across, but people have to... We have to work for stability.
The quote from you...
Stability works
for
them.
Jerusalem Post was better the devil you know.
Yeah. Stability works for them. Has worked greatly. Ariel?
Something that like has weighed my mind when I see all these revolutions happening in different places, when I see what's happening in Egypt, that we certainly had it in South America, in Chile, Argentina, and Uruguay, that the, after we've denounced the dictatorships enough, or they become delegitimized because they get into stupid wars, or Argentina, and. What happens after is that there's a big movement for democracy. And a lot of the times, of course, the more radical voices like get silenced, and as you were saying, capitalism goes back to business because like a lot of what happened in Spain, what happened in South America, it's all about like making sure that we learn that free market capitalism is the only system. So it's all about kind of like hammering it home as hard as possible. And I guess my point is that when we've seen all these kind of failed transitions to false democracies, to false pro-capitalist democracies, do you see that it's more possible, or that there's like certain factors in Egypt and in other places in the region that would make it maybe easier to fight this tendency, which is also supported by like all the mainstream. Leftist parties would support because they just pay lip service to democracy, but it's always free market capitalism, no matter what. Mm-hmm. No matter what. So.
Mm-hmm. I want to start stating straight away that I do. I don't think there's nothing unavoidable about repeating the mistakes from the past. Actually, there are subjective and objective factors, and I'm going to start with the subjective. First, that we have these experiences. We have plenty of them. We have to share them. People have to know about them, okay? And that's a very important role for the revolutionary left, okay? And I do agree with that. So I think that there's a subjective hindrance there, and it's this kind of old Stalinist legacy of people that still believe that we have to confine this to a democratic bourgeois revolution, okay? And you have that discourse as well going on in some sectors. Now, how are you going to have a... I don't know. I mean, it's reactionary because the people did go during the Tahrir days, went beyond pure democratic bourgeois institutions. They created the right democracy. So you're kind of trying to rein the people somehow. At the same time, it's unworkable because you're talking about a democratic revolution at a moment that's long gone, and at the same time when you're denying your own role as socialist left
in general. I'm not talking just about anarchists or Trotskyists or whatever. I'm talking about in general, even the Stalinists that are denying their own political role. So I think that that's a hindrance, but at the same time, I think there's plenty of evidence. There are subjective factors in terms of the empowerment of the people. I mean, there was a big banner that said the Egyptian people have tasted freedom already, so there's no return back. And I think that that's how a lot of people feel. And now I'm going back to the objective factor. And the objective factor is that the struggle in Egypt was relatively painless and quite quick. If you compare it to the transition in Spain, if you compare it to transitions in Central America, if you compare it to transitions in Chile, we were in the face of very protracted struggles that really took a heavy toll on the revolutionaries in particular, that took a heavy toll on the people. And I remember, I mean, in Chile from 83 to 86, you had one general strike every month for 3 years. And that generated into an all-struggle, street fighting for a week. I mean, the country was completely dysfunctional. So the possibility of a pacific transition to democracy came in 88, and the people were willing to take it because people were objectively very tired. Now the people are not tired, so they toppled the dictatorship by their own means, not through a referendum like us, not through a negotiated agreement. They toppled it by their own means, and they're still in a capacity of, well, so what do we do next? I remember 1990 in Chile, no one was thinking, what do we do next? It was like, ah, sure, thanks God, the fucker's gone. Do you know what I mean? So that's a very important objective factor, that the toll was less heavy, and that means that the best sons and daughters of Egypt are not gone to a mass grave. And secondly, that the working class won relatively quickly. And that I think will have a big impact in how the post-Mubarak Egypt moves towards something a bit more radical than the democracy they want to build up. I don't think that this rules out that a transition still can happen. And actually, that's a very likely scenario as well. But what I want to say is that the ultimate word is not said. And things are fluid and things can change. And that's why it's important to create those links, to exchange experiences and help our brothers and sisters to move the struggle forward.
Okay, I'm afraid that's all we've got time for. I'd like to say thanks once again to our speaker, Jose Antonio.
This audio is from the 2011 Dublin Anarchist Book Fair. You'll find more audio from the Dublin Anarchist Book Fair at www.wsm.ie.